Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's articles are from the April 2025 edition. A surprise guest. Sometimes a little bit of history can go a long way. By Sid Evans. A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak to the Memphis Garden Club at the Dixon Gallery and Gardens, one of the crown jewels of my hometown. I mentioned to my host, Pam Martin, that I'm not a very talented gardener. Despite years of trying, I have struck out again and again with heirloom tomatoes. But she assured me the members were much more interested in what's happening at Southern Living. They wanted to hear about things like our history and our future, how we come up with the story ideas, whether the grumpy gardener is really that grumpy. He is. When I was thinking about what to say, I realized I might be able to invite a special guest. As many of you know, the cover of our first issue in 1966 was photographed at a home in Mobile, Alabama, with two little girls pedaling a red tandem bicycle through a yard full of azaleas. One of those girls is Joanne Magnus Fusco, who now lives in Memphis, and she, amazingly, still has the bike. Despite some correspondence leading up to the magazine's 50th anniversary in 2016, I had never met Joanne, though I felt like I knew her. When I reached out and asked if she'd like to bring the bike to the talk, she was delighted and even got a local florist to dress it up a bit. Not surprisingly, Joanne and the bike were the stars of the show. After the talk was over, I was able to meet Dale Skaggs, who has been the director of horticulture at the Dixon since 2007. He told me about the extraordinary tulip program they've developed, planting more than 250,000 bulbs every spring. For the whole story, I will read Cameron Bell's Blooming in Concert. I had grown up hearing about this place, which was founded in 1976, after Hugo Dixon and his wife Margaret left their 17-acre estate to the city to become a public art museum and garden. I'd been to events and wedding receptions here, but I hadn't really thought about how lucky Memphis was to have a gem like the Dixon in the heart of town, and people like Dale to take care of it. As we were leaving, I asked Joanne if she had any plans for the famous family heirloom, and she wasn't sure. She said that she'd kept it not only because of the Southern Living connection, but also because it had been a gift from her father to her mother, who had somehow never learned to ride. Wherever it is, I like knowing that a small piece of our history is still in good hands, and I'm grateful to Joanne for taking care of it. I doubt my friends at the Memphis Garden Club remember much of what I said about the magazine that day, but no one will forget the magical bike that was rolled into the Dixon. Sid Evans, Editor-in-Chief. Blooming in Concert. Dixon Gallery and Gardens in Memphis plants more than 250,000 tulips a year for a spring spectacular, by Cameron Bell. Dixon Gallery and Gardens is small, but mighty. It may not be the state's largest botanical garden, but the cultural spark in the heart of Memphis delivers well beyond its mere 17 acres. It is home to not only hundreds of unique plants, native azaleas, tulips, woodland wildflowers, heirloom roses, daffodils, and trilliums, but also a permanent art collection with works by Henri Matisse, Vincent van Gogh, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Edgar Degas, and more. The synergy between the gardens and the museum is where we shine, explains Director of Horticulture Dale Skaggs, who has worked there since 2007. The Dixon is small by public garden standards, and the museum and collections are not large, But when you put the two together, it's really special. The land was originally home to Hugo Dixon, an Englishman with a penchant for collecting French Impressionist artwork and a reverence for gardening. He moved to the States and fell in love with Margaret Oates, a Mississippi girl who was also an avid gardener and a member of the Memphis Garden Club. In the 1940s, when building their Georgian-style house, now the museum, Dixon took great care to preserve the trees and planted historical varieties, which inspire much of the estate's layout and cultivars today. The couple had no children, so as philanthropists and supporters of the local arts, they left the estate with an endowment for all of Memphis to enjoy. It was officially converted into a public museum and garden in 1976. One of the magical things about the Dixon is the intimate scale and residential feel, says Skaggs. It's not so vast, and the spaces are divided up into garden rooms, so it feels very approachable. The main areas include a sunny south lawn, an educational garden, woodland gardens carved out of the shaded landscape, English-style formal gardens with a series of three rooms originally designed by Dixon himself, and the Memphis Garden Club cutting garden with grid-like beds located near the entrance. Today, the focus at the Dixon is on the core assortment of ferns, boxwoods, cold-hardy camellias, and azaleas, with an emphasis on native varieties. We want to build our collections so they are meaningful, and so we're doing something good to preserve some of these rare plants, explains Skaggs. But every March, when the chorus of colorful blooms breaks through the frost-hardened soil, the impressive sight is unlike any other. Tulips are one-shot wonders, he notes. You plant them, and they're like fireworks. Then they're gone. A tulip tradition. In 2011, the cutting beds were first filled with 12,000 bulbs. Everyone loved it and wanted to come to see them. It really struck a chord with the community, he says. You couldn't make it down the aisles because it was so congested. The dazzling display was expanded to other nooks of the property the following year, with the number of bulbs reaching 25,000. From there, we got hooked on tulips, he says. Now each winter, starting when the weather cools, the team plants an astounding 250,000 new bulbs that arrive directly from Holland. In the cutting plots, each shines on its own. The tulips make a patchwork quilt because we plant them in little sections, each one with a different cultivar. Noting that there are more than 85 individual niches, it's one of the most beautiful spaces, and really just draws you in with the colors. In landscape beds, you'll find that the shades mix and mingle. There's this alchemy that you get when the sum is greater than the parts. When you put them together and they bloom in concert, he says, they make more of a statement than they would individually. Plan your visit. Peaking from mid-March through mid-April, the cherry tulips attract over 30,000 visitors for their grand show, but the property provides an array of flowering bulbs with various spring bloom times before tapering into azalea season. Admission is free and all are welcome. We've worked on taking down barriers, says Skaggs. We strive for universal access so everyone can use the same entrance. A passion for azaleas. A story of devotion is planted amid the blooms of Bellingrath Gardens by Caroline Rogers. To see the azaleas, you'll have to drive south, farther south, even than Mobile, to a tiny town called Theodore, Alabama. There, wisteria laces the tops of ancient oaks, their limbs sleeved in resurrection ferns and dripping mosses. Palm trees peek from behind houses. Flower beds go technicolor. It's spring, and everything is waking up. Once you pass the signs for Theodore, billboards beckon you to venture even farther. Only then will you reach Bellingrath Gardens and home, one of the state's most beautiful places. Beyond the entrance, flashes of pink wink beneath the trees. Although Bellingrath welcomes visitors year-round, azalea season lights up the grounds like no other. Take any of the curving paths through the property's 65 acres, and you'll find thick walls of blossoms reaching up and over in every possible shade. Magenta, coral, fuchsia, cotton candy, blush, salmon, ruby, and cream. Small blooms and large ones, more than 250,000 mingle in the hedges, their branches heavy with sun-dappled petals. They look as if they've always been there. The flowers go back nearly a century, and it's a love story for the ages. The beginnings of Bellingrath. Doctors will tell you that if you listen to a patient long enough, they'll tell you exactly what's wrong with them, explains Tom McGeehee, the director of Bellingrath Gardens and Home. Its namesake. Walter Bellingrath was one of the first Coca-Cola bottlers in Alabama, and he was notoriously close with his money. So when he saw a property which was once a sawmill operation and then a fishing camp, ideally suited along the Fowl River, he was hesitant to buy it. But he was also an avid fisherman and talked about it all the time. He went to his doctor to complain about an unrelated ailment, but the land was foremost on his mind. By the end of the appointment, the physician had a prescription. Buy the property, Mr. Bellingrath's doctor told him. You have to learn to play, says McGeehee with a twinkle in his eye, and that doctor was my grandfather. McGeehee has been with Bellingrath Gardens since 1994, and in the years since has become a fount of knowledge about the home, the land, and the stories of the people who once lived there. As he stands outside the house on a sunny day, he tells the tale of Bessie and Walter Bellingrath and the garden they loved. When Mr. Bellingrath purchased the land in 1917, he used it as a fishing retreat, McGeehee explains. However, Bessie, his wife, saw the potential in the grounds and set about establishing a garden. She had a particular passion for azaleas, he says, gesturing to the profusion of blooms along the pathway, and she began planting old-growth shrubs, enlisting the help of architect George B. Rogers, who designed both the outdoor spaces and the home. While Walter always pinched pennies, Bessie's generosity was legendary, especially with the people who worked there. When one staff member told her he was saving his money to purchase a car, she gave him a check for the balance of the vehicle, says McGeehee. And when the man approached her with plans to pay her back, Mrs. Bellingrath said, "That wasn't a loan, you know." A flush of flowers. During the Great Depression, Bessie added to the gardens in an unexpected way. The economic downturn loomed large, and the situation for many families in the Mobile area worsened. Bessie's friends regularly shared with her the names of families who were having a difficult time, and she would visit them at their homes. While there, she would identify a plant, typically an azalea, or a camellia in the yard, and offered to buy it from the owners, who were astonished at the large sum of money she paid them. Thus the gardens grew, and the flowers multiplied. In 1932, the Bellingraths opened the property to the public for the spring, and it became so popular that they decided a couple of years later to allow visitors throughout the seasons. Bessie's health declined during the 1940s, and she died in 1943. After that, Walter turned all of his attention to the gardens and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on their upkeep. He dedicated the rest of his life to the landscape she'd loved. He once said, "These gardens were my wife's dream, and I want to live to see that dream come true." A landscape of memories. Azaleas thrive here, but there is more to experience beyond the blossoms. Follow shaded flagstone paths, past quiet nooks, ringed with wrought iron benches, and walls of greenery. Tour the home, where opulently decorated rooms are filled with antiques, fine furniture, and objects d'art. See the conservatory, the rose garden, the great lawn, and the bayou boardwalk that stretches out over the river and curves back toward land. A bridge extends across the man-made Mirror Lake, which has grassy banks bordered by broad sweeps of hot pink azaleas. It's evident in even the smallest details that this place was built with sustained dedication of many hands. The gardens continued to be a comfort to Walter at the end of his life. After Bessie's death, he lived the rest of his days on the river, conversing with visitors and marveling at the flowers opening beneath the oaks. Above a writing desk in the Bellingrath home hangs a print of the epitaph Walter wrote for his late wife's gravestone. It reads, "I shall always think of you wandering through a lovely garden, like that which you fashioned with your own hands, where flowers never fade, and no cold wind of sorrow blights our hopes and plans, and on your face the peace of one whose whole life through walked with God." We have come to the end of our program. I'm Joyce Davis, and I will be back soon.